Hey, Peter.
Hey, John. How you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. So, another episode of Blogging Heads.
That's right. Number two.
Good. Good. So we were going to start out talking about patriotism.
That's right. We both wrote about patriotism recently, and I figure you should get the ball rolling and tell me what you how you see the lay of the land.
Excellent. Well, so I wrote this piece for the last the kind of 4th of July issue of Time magazine about how liberals and conservatives see patriotism differently, and I made a couple points. The first was that I think conservatives tend to see patriotism as affirmation, you know, affirmation of your love of country or your pride in how great a country America is. I think liberals tend to be more comfortable with patriotism as dissent, you know, patriotism as calling your country on the carpet for not living up to the ideals that you think it should embody and that are embodied in its founding documents. And I think that that's connected to some different assumptions that liberals and conservatives make. I think the first is simply about how great America is. I think that conservatives are more comfortable saying that America is a great country because they have a darker view of human nature. They tend to be more conscious of the fact that most countries around in human history have been tyrannical. And they think it's a pretty remarkable accomplishment that America survived as a democracy at all, given the sinful nature of human beings. I think liberals, because they tend to be more invested in the idea of progress, more hopeful about human possibility, I think tend to think more in terms of what America could be, and tend to compare America to a vision they have of the country that America could and should be, but will only achieve through political struggle. I think conservatives are also, I think both liberals and conservatives see America as a set of ideas enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, not simply as a kind of set of cultural traditions like other societies have. But I think that conservatives are more comfortable putting that aside and saying, well, even when America doesn't live up to those principles, we should still love America simply because it's ours. In the same way we love our family, not because we necessarily think it's better than someone else's, but just because we think it's ours. I think liberals are a little less comfortable with that kind of patriotism, which is kind of boldly accepts that we love America not necessarily because it's any better than any other country, but simply because it's our country. And for me, kind of in some ways, the acid test maybe of liberal and conservative patriotism, or one interesting historical question is to go back and read this, you know, incredible 1852 statement by Frederick Douglass called, you know, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July," where Douglass gives this incredible speech in Rochester, New York, saying, "I will not celebrate the 4th of July while my people are in bondage. It does not deserve my celebration." And I think for liberals, I think many would see that as actually an act of quintessential patriotism. But my suspicion is that conservatives would be uncomfortable. Of course, they would share liberal deep hatred of slavery, but would be uncomfortable seeing Douglass's unwillingness to celebrate the 4th as a quintessentially patriotic act.
Again, I think there's a lot to agree with. I think there's a lot that's defensible. But the point of this conversation is to highlight differences as much as anything else. And so my first blush at that is I think it leaves out a couple things. First of all, I think your description of what defines liberal patriotism would be more apt in the 1950s, the 1940s, pretty much any time prior to the 1960s, even though I think you can find different historical strains even there. In this regard, liberals used to talk about exclusively in the way you're talking about, in about making America all that it can be, mm-hmm. and all of these sorts of things, and that reform and patriotism were intermingled and all the rest. And people forget how much sort of real nationalism was involved in American liberalism prior to the 1960s. I mean, liberal historians like Eric Lichtenberg and William Lichtenberg and others, you know, they referred to the New Dealers as economic nationalists. You know, these were nationalists in many ways. Certainly the progressives had a huge strain of nationalism running through them, both in the TR branch and in the Wilson branch. But something has happened, in my mind, to liberalism, which has made it increasingly cosmopolitan. And the sort of Tennyson's notion of a parliament of man has seemed to have taken hold. If you look at what a lot of liberals write about patriotism in you know recently, there is this, you get this sense, it's sort of this Rawlsian thing, you know, whatever, that garment of ignorance, whatever they call it, the veil of ignorance thing.
Veil of ignorance.
Where, you know, I had something on the corner, I didn't read Iglesias' original post, but we had something on the corner excerpting something Iglesias wrote about, you know, the arbitrariness of being born American, which I think gets to your point about loving it just because it's ours. You know, it's like being born American is like being born into wealth, and why should you think you deserve that, you know, more than somebody else, or something along those lines. You know, you could have just as easily been born a Botswanan or a Mexican or whatever, and so therefore, you know, you need to look at things from further back. And I think it's this sort of Olympian perspective that you get in a lot of liberalism, this cosmopolitan view that as America, quote-unquote, matures, as it evolves, as it progresses, you know, all these laden verbs thing involving, you know, us getting better through the, you know, by continuing the current trends, your attachment to being American just because you're American will start to fade away. And you'll see yourself, you know, the French, they talk about, you know, they're not into French values anymore, they're into human values. There is this idea of this this Parliament of Man notion where no ideas of sort of particularity and localism are antediluvian, and that they need to be sort of sloughed off. And you see this in sort of in the liberal wing of the Supreme Court casting about, looking in the laws of foreign countries and polls in foreign countries to determine what our constitution means. You get this in the sort of sense that these transnational elites in the Davos and sort of, you know, UN crowd, that somehow they're really onto something, and that the problems of particularity, like in the EU, are things that really need to be thrown off, like notions of ethnicity and even other opiates of the masses. And so I think there is a certain globalistic vision that comes in contemporary liberalism, which doesn't so much want to perfect America as transcend Americanness. And I think that's one of the things that is that really separates the conservative and liberal view. And so what bothers me is when liberals talk about patriotism is it's a patriotism shorn in many respects of Americanness. It is a patriotism which just says, we should do good as determined by a sort of global transnational aristocracy of do-gooders and adhering to that stuff by making America better, by making it in effect less American, seems to define a great deal of patriotic rhetoric these days. I mean, Barack Obama, he talks about making America better by remaking it, by reinventing it. The aesthetics of his campaign are about a revolution. Well, it seems to me if you believe this country needs a revolution, if you believe that it needs to be remade, then your love for it isn't that profound.
Well, wait a second. I mean, first of all, the rhetoric revolution is certainly not a rhetoric that's confined to liberals, right? Both Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich talked about revolution, you know, and Gingrich was talked about, is associated with the term revolution certainly more than Barack Obama.
That's fair.
So this is I think there's something to what you're saying, but I think you pushed it way too far. There is no question that there are philosophers that we would probably think of as liberals, like Martha Nussbaum, George Kateb, who basically believe in cosmopolitan values and believe that the patriotism is an affront to the Enlightenment because they believe that we should have no particular affiliations with people for non-rational reasons, that we should see ourselves as part of a universal human community, and that if we have certain affiliations with people that are based on people who share our ideals, that's one thing. But that we shouldn't arbitrarily form teams and clubs which based on just the city that we come from or something like that. And that idea is also older. I mean, there are lots of Tolstoy. I mentioned this in my timepiece. Tolstoy kind of spoke that way. That's an old idea. But I think first of all, it's not exclusively an idea of the left in the sense that if you think about where the greatest assaults on American sovereignty have come in the post-Cold War era, I think it's pretty clear that they have come actually from the libertarian right, the business-oriented right. I mean, you think about the debate over WTO, for instance, which basically institution which has the capacity to potentially override certain national laws because all corporations have to be treated equally, regardless of which country they're originating from. Now, Pat Buchanan went nuts about this because he saw it as a violation of American sovereignty, but a lot of the criticism of that was coming from an actually quite kind of localist anti-globalization left. I mean, you think about someone like that guy, José Bové in France. He's nothing if not a localist anti-globalization guy of the left, and I think he has analogs to some degree in the United States. So I think that, you know, when you're talking about the Cato Institute and the Wall Street Journal and their view on immigration and their view on the fact that you should be able to supersede national laws if it's better for multinational corporations, I think that interferes with your story. I also think that the story of change is not nearly as clear as you mentioned. I mean, you mentioned this Tennyson poem, The Parliament of Man, but who was the president who walked around with that poem in his pocket and said, this is what I ultimately believe we're all destined to? It was Harry Truman, you know, the liberal president the conservatives most love. Even if you look at some of the things that Woodrow Wilson said, although yes, it's true that he was a nationalist in many ways, his vision of international cooperation was more radical than anything that Barack Obama was talking about. So I think that there is this strand amongst liberals, but not only amongst liberals, and I don't think that the story of its growth is nearly as clear as you make it out to be.
Well, I mean, first of all, you make a very good point about the sort of market capitalism, libertarianism, and I'll ponder that for a moment, but it's a good and fair point. That said, I did say that these strands predate. I mean, there's, you know, these great essays in The Nation magazine called These United States, where sort of one progressive intellectual after another is casting about, mid-1920s, you know, casting about, going around, visiting all the different regions of the U.S.,
yes,
and coming
yeah,
back
no,
and talking
exactly
about what sort of, you know, bozos and bumpkins, you know, these Americans are because they don't subscribe to these cosmopolitan values. This has always been, I agree, it's always been a strand. I think that strand has gotten much stronger in liberalism since the 1960s. But that, you know, you can find antecedents for every cultural phenomenon.
Right? Isn't it Stearns, Harold Stearns edits that book that you're talking about?
No, Harold Stearns was one of those writers. He was associated with those writers. His was Civilization in America, he wrote.
Yeah, but didn't he edit that book of where they all went out and did essays about different states? I could be confusing two books, but anyway, go ahead.
He might have. They might have turned the, because originally these things were in The Nation, mm-hmm. but Stearns did a lot of this stuff. I mean, Stearns was, you know, your former New Republic colleague, who was so disgusted by what happened in World War I, he went and moved to Paris and decided to define liberalism as just sort of individualized do-goodery. But regardless, I think you stumbled on another point I want to sort of get back to, which touches on this idea that conservatives just love America because it is ours. You know, Ramesh Panuru, my colleague at National Review, you know, he sort of made this point criticizing or disagreeing with a colleague in NR by saying, Ramesh was asking sarcastically, do we have to believe, the conservatives have to believe, do patriots have to believe we're the best country in the world, mm-hmm. or can't we just love it because it's our country? I think, you know, Ramesh says, you know, I love my mom more than any other mom, mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily argue that she's the best mom in the world, even though
yes.
I might have gotten her a coffee cup that said so.
Yes.
And Mark Hemingway, the colleague who Ramesh was responding to, had a good response. He says, you know, you make a good point, and maybe it was unclear, but at the same time, you know, we love our mothers also because out of all of the people in the world, with the possible exception of our fathers, speaking as a generalization, they do more for us to make us who we are. And there's a certain level of ingratitude by just simply saying, to carry the analogy out, to simply say, well, it was just pure happenstance that this country happened to be my mother country, and therefore I shouldn't show too much gratitude to it. But I think that what interests me about that discussion was I thought Ramesh was giving short shrift to the idea that there is something more than warm, fuzzy sentiment to patriotism on the right. I mean, conservatives, at least, you know, the modern conservatives in the Reagan tradition, actually believe that the founding fathers were the only successful revolutionaries maybe not the only ones, but you know, compared to the French revolutionaries and the revolutions of those times, were the only successful revolutionaries who created something spectacular and new on the world stage. And I think liberals, maybe it's because of their perceived, and I think really foolhardy, sense of indebtedness to the French Revolution, or maybe it's because they've imbibed too much of this sort of dead white male bashing, or Charles Beard, you know, pure economic determinism, you know, arguments. I think a lot of liberals make an enormous mistake, both politically, but more importantly, intellectually and philosophically, not recognizing the revolutionary nature of the American Revolution. And I think conservatives who don't like to talk in that sort of language downplay it. You know, the world owes an enormous debt of gratitude to the American Revolution. You know, Iglesias allegedly in that post was talking about how, you know, America would still be pretty awesome if we had come to some nice compromise with the British and stayed in the Commonwealth and all of the rest and blah, 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 blah. Which I think is not only nonsense, but it sort of shows how degraded the sense of gratitude that liberals should hold because of their liberal values to the triumph of the American Revolution.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that there's a debate about how revolutionary the founding was, and I think that's actually not a debate in which you would say that conservatives are the ones saying it's more revolutionary. I mean, I think a lot of conservatives, I think Irving Kristol, actually what they like about the founding is precisely they think it wasn't that revolutionary.
Yeah, it was only sufficient. It was only revolutionary enough to actually be successful. I mean, Irving's point is that it was a pragmatic revolution. You know, the essay is, you know, the American Revolution as a successful revolution. Mm. It was successful precisely because of its insights into human nature and how to structure human affairs in ways that the left, the sort of French revolutionaries, could not grasp.
That's all fine and good. And obviously, look, there were obviously different people. And, you know, as I think the critics of Irving Kristol have noticed that he leaves Thomas Paine out of his story. So that there, you know, there are a group of people involved in the founding who have quite, some of whom are actually a lot more, a lot closer to the French Revolution and some are much, much further from. But, when you talk about this becomes a very hackneyed conversation, but whenever it is that conservatives say, why is it that liberals don't appreciate the brilliance of the founding, liberals always respond, well, these documents were marred at birth by condoning the most grotesque of human evils, and that the American story has been about trying to, some liberals would say, more moderate liberals would say, the story is about trying to live up to the true meaning of those documents, such that we could overcome the evils that marred it at its birth. Others, I think, would be more radical, would say that actually, there's not that even the ideals in of themselves in many ways were had a quite dim view of the idea of human equality and that were quite dramatic transformations were necessary to actually bring about, I think, the values that kind of contemporary liberals and conservatives would agree with. But when one talks about the idea of gratitude, I think that conservatives don't take seriously at all the statement that I think was kind of both put best by Chris Rock. I think, you know, Chris Rock said, "Look, being black in America is like America's the rich guy or rich parent who sends you to college but also rapes you." You know, I mean, there is this very, very dark history, and the history is not dead. It's still with us in many ways. And I think that liberals liberals can't tell the story without talking about them. The story just doesn't make any sense. Whereas I find that although conservatives are, of course, aware of all that and will acknowledge it, it is striking to me that when they first tell the story, you know, unbidden, they usually leave that out.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. You would say conservatives give short shrift to the issue of slavery in the American founding.
And women, I mean, yada, yada, yada.
Okay. And I would say that in many ways you're playing to type, right? I mean, you think that the story of the American founding is a story of blacks and women being left out. And while I think that is a
Not entirely, but I think that's an important part of the story.
Oh, I think it's a perfectly fine... I think you're perfectly right to say it's an important part of the story, but I think that you took the conversation this way to say that liberals can't talk about the founding without talking about these things, I think understates the case, is that they can't talk about the founding in almost any other way. And they can't... That, you know, this idea that... You know, look, I think, obviously, not racism, but slavery was the signature evil of the American story, and I have no problem saying that. But at the same time, I think there is there's this weird notion that somehow it is a uniquely American story. I mean, the amazing thing to me about slavery in Western civilization generally is that Western civilization put an end to it, and it put an end to it not only in our own backyards, but throughout the globe. I mean, slavery was a natural but it was a universal institution for most of human history. And it says something wonderful about Western civilization that we were the ones to put an end to it, not just at home but abroad as well. And in this country, we fought a civil war that stacked human body, stacked white body after white body like cordwood to put the issue to bed, and then we struggled with it for another, 70 years. I mean, the idea that somehow, and that is in many ways the only story that gets a full airing in civics and all of the rest, and it leaves out, and I think it shows the sort of the problem liberals get caught up in talking about patriotism, is that they immediately want to go to these things fine, that glass is half full or half empty, but it seems to me not a grotesquely unfair generalization to say that when it comes to sort of patriotic talk about our country, liberals incessantly, which gets to your point about dissent and reform, incessantly talk about the empty part. To the detriment of the full part, and maybe that's true vice versa, but I would rather be on the side of that I'm on in that division.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're painting a somewhat caricatured picture of liberals. I think, at least, if you listen to Barack Obama or any Democratic presidential candidate, they are always celebrating the glory of America's founding, but... You're right. I mean, I think in some ways this is a kind of dysfunctional dance that liberals and conservatives have, where each of them are playing a role, and it's precisely because conservatives don't discuss this, liberals don't feel like conservatives discuss it very much, that liberals feel like they are obligated to discuss it for fear that it wouldn't be discussed at all. But I think that there's also something significant about the way you tell the story about America overcoming slavery and segregation, which is that America did it. Western civilization did it. I mean, the way liberals are more likely to talk about it was that this was a great struggle within America and within Western civilization between some people who said, who defended the status quo, and said that America was that this America was fine as it is, and in fact that slavery and segregation were entirely in harmony with America's principles, and a group of people, many of whom were very, very radical, many of whom seemed very unpatriotic, many of whom seemed unwilling to kind of talk about America's greatness because they were constantly focusing on the grave injustice of America, who through a kind of struggle, continuous struggle, managed to ultimately prevail. And I think, the question that I have, that I think ultimately goes, the nub of this seems to me, is the question at what point you think that people who are being held in bondage in the United States have a responsibility to salute the flag and express their love of country. I mean, it seems to me, at the one extreme, it seems to me you can't expect Frederick Douglass in 1852 to celebrate the 4th of July. And I think it's even an open question to what degree you should expect African Americans in 1952 to salute the flag and celebrate the 4th of July. And I think that's the very difficult question that I think conservatives don't seem to want to wrestle with at all, which is to say there may have been times in American history where we were not a good enough country, at least to some of our citizens, to deserve their allegiance.
Okay, I mean, if we want to talk about the issue of black patriotism, that'd be a lovely topic to get into for another time.
I shouldn't even say black patriotism. For that matter, I mean, it shouldn't even matter whether you're white or black. I mean, the question is, have there been certain moments in our history where the country was doing things that were so monstrous that any person of conscience, regardless of race, should have been opposed to the idea of a patriotism of affirmation?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question, and I'd like to think about it, but it sounds to me like you're practicing a pretty awful large amount of Whiggish, historicism here, where you're going and you're applying today's standards to the past, when as if somehow the model of a sort of modern colorblind society was one that seemed around the corner and easily implemented and within the gamut of the imagined possibilities of daily life. And I'm not entirely sure that's fair or accurate. And, you know, your description of the sort of battle of the forces against oppression, against the forces of status quo or reaction, I think is fine as long as you're talking about it at a level of very high abstraction and generality. But I would hate for viewers to think that what you're talking about is a contest between liberals and conservatives, which is really taking a contemporary prism and laying it over a much more complicated set of affairs. I mean, Herbert Spencer, the famous social Darwinist, that the reformers and progressives despised and laid at his feet most of the evils of the 20th century, was a radical libertarian abolitionist who was in favor of women's suffrage and all of the rest. The people were fighting slavery were the abolitionists were what Andrew Sullivan and his crowd would call Christianists par excellence.
Many, but not all. A great many of them.
It's a much more complicated story. The British, who are the ones who take the lead at ending slavery in the world, were also the imperialists par excellence. I mean, these things don't cut neatly the way today many liberals talk about these things. It's much more complicated thing, with conservatives having antecedents on the side of truth and justice and right, and liberals having antecedents on the side of evil and vice versa. And so I think
I don't disagree with that. Transferring contemporary definitions of liberal conservative to the 19th century, I agree. I agree that's problematic. That wasn't what I was trying to suggest.
But I mean, okay, fair enough. Well, we are 28 minutes into this one. As to your question of whether or not there were times in American life where America didn't deserve the allegiance of its citizens, mm-hmm. I think it is a fascinating question to ask. I certainly think that slaves had every right and every obligation. Not every obligation. You don't have the obligation to kill yourself, but they have every right for want of a better word, every right, to launch as many rebellions as they could get away with. Mm. They certainly owed nothing to the United States at the time. But beyond that, I think it's a really interesting and problematic question that I would hate to try to answer in 40 seconds, so we'll leave it for our next exciting edition of Blogging Heads, I think.
That's great. Maybe we'll come back to it. There was a related topic that you just wrote a column about, which is about national service, which many people, including Barack Obama and John McCain, actually linked to patriotism. But you're not such a big fan of the idea, so why don't you explain why?
Yeah. Let's define our terms first of all. National service, if you're talking about volunteering and doing good things for your country, for your community, for all of those things, I think that's great stuff. And I think it should be applauded and recognized by the culture and encouraged at the local level wherever possible. My problem is this with this sort of top-down AmeriCorps, Freedom Corps, this corps, that corps, vision of national service that involves, in effect, paying people to volunteer. And if you go both on the left and the right, this is a very, my complaint is with the level of bipartisanship on this issue. You're right, John McCain is in this, you know, up to his neck. George Bush is very sympathetic. John Edwards and Chris Dodd campaigned this season, this year for the president, arguing for compulsory, mandatory national service. So it's a bipartisan thing. I find that really repugnant. And I find it not only sort of contrary to American tradition, American norms, it's actually counterproductive. We, in fact, volunteer more in this country than we do in these countries that have national service, mandatory national service. America is more charitable than these other countries that have national service. And yet we are constantly told that national service and private civil society, Burkean little platoon volunteering is not real or worthwhile or really completely legitimate. Richard Stengel in Time magazine basically made this argument, unless the government somehow gets involved and runs the thing. And that bothers me, and it bothers me for a very specific reason. I don't think, you know, even though I think there is some 13th Amendment problems with compulsory servitude in this country, my real problem boils down to a cultural one. That if you are willing to raise a generation of kids who are told, who are sort of indoctrinated into this idea that public service is only something that you do for the government or at the government's behest or under the government's supervision, you are enculturating a generation to really turn the American conception of things on its head, the sort of de Tocquevillian understanding of these things on its head. And, you know, you're fond of that Pat Moynihan quote where Moynihan says, you know, the central conservative truth is that culture matters more than politics, mm-hmm. and the central liberal truth is that politics can change culture. Mm-hmm. I think that's right, but it doesn't necessarily mean that changing the politics always improves the culture. And I think on this one, considering our volunteerism is better than these alleged role model countries are anyway, and that this is one of the great things that American civil society does right anyway, changing the culture through politics is a bad idea on pragmatic grounds as well as on the sort of philosophical ones.
So you would have a problem with compulsory military service as well?
Well, I have a problem with compulsory military service if compulsory military service isn't needed at a time of war. You know, the draft, you know, the Constitution is in the suicide pact, all that kind of stuff. You know, the draft is a bad thing. It has a lot of benefits. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there are a lot of benefits. I always thought it was weird how liberals haven't noticed how many benefits there have been to the draft. But at the end of the day,
there've been people. Charlie Rangel introduced this bill, and I mean, there've been
people. But that Charlie Rangel thing. I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I always took that to be a remarkably cynical thing. It was grounded in opposition to the war, so that, you know, if we had a draft, we wouldn't have the war. And it was a way of pointing out the hypocrisy of the right and all these sorts of things, sending poor people off to fight rich men's wars and all that kind of thing. I do not think it was a serious desire for a sort of policy of national unity and all that kind of stuff. It was theatrics, and I thought it was pretty despicable, to be honest.
Well, I mean, but the two things are not entirely interlinked. I mean, the inevitable product of having a draft is that you change the politics of going to war. And so I don't think you can entirely disentangle the two, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. That may be one of the benefits of having a draft, is it raises the threshold mm-hmm. of committing troops to war. I think that's fair. Americans would no doubt be much less, you know, enthusiastic about wars if we still had a draft. I think the left is right in that observation. But that is not in and of itself an argument for a draft. Draft, you know, the draft is you know, an incredible, you know, in some ways, you know, to me it's very, you know, I think Milton Friedman was right on this. It is very comparable to slavery. And in some ways it's worse than slavery insofar as you're forcing people to kill other people and be killed. Now, it's an evil, but it's a necessary evil sometimes. Dragooning college-bound high school juniors to pick up garbage off the side of the road is much less pressing a need than, you know, defeating Nazi Germany or the Kaiser.
Well, I think to some degree you're conflating two things. I mean, I haven't followed the National Service debate that much, but my sense is the far more mainstream position is to try to provide people incentives to voluntarily do national service. You're arguing against that, but it seems to me you're taking the more extreme proposals, which are for mandatory national service, and lumping them together, where it seems to me your arguments are strongest in when you're arguing against the position that is actually much less mainstream, if I understand
that's fair. Right. I would argue that the compulsory thing is more mainstream than you think on both the Republican and Democratic side. And I think that much of what Obama is proposing is fairly compulsory. He's talking about using education funding to force schools to make public service mandatory. And if you listen to his speech about how he's going to require this many hours of community service for high school kids, this many hours for college service for college kids, and how he's going to, you know, he's going to make sure that the federal government sees these goals are met, even if he comes up just shy of outright compulsory national service, he moves the ball very far down the field towards exactly that. And again, John Edwards and Chris Dodd called for exactly that in their campaigns. I don't think that they represent, you know, extreme fringe of the Democratic Party.
Well, I guess it's an interesting question. I mean, do you have a problem with compulsory jury duty?
No, I guess I don't.
But, I mean, it seems to me your argument, I mean, obviously, when you know, you're not being asked to sacrifice a huge amount by doing jury duty, but still, you are being asked to do it, and I mean, you're not being asked to; you're being required to do it. And it seems to me, at some cost to your liberty, and it seems to me you could make your logic, which is to say it stifles the de Tocquevillian voluntarist spirit, would apply there too. Why not allow people to volunteer to do jury duty and have and allow people's to do it out of genuine patriotic sentiment, and maybe you'd find that actually you had more people who genuinely wanted to be jurors and were better jurors.
That's an interesting point, but I mean, I think it's one of those examples where you're taking the logic to an extreme that doesn't necessarily undermine any of my criticisms of national service. I mean, it seems to me jury duty, one is, I mean, there seems to be, there's something in there in the Constitution about jury duty, right? And
I think
or at least about jurors.
Jurors, your poor peers. I don't know if it requires that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure either. But, you know, again, like the draft, I am not against any imposition on human liberty or anything like that. You know, I mean, I'm for local censorship. I'm for all sorts of things that aren't strictly libertarian in these regards. Every poison is in the dosage, right? I mean, a little bit of anything won't kill you. Mm-hmm. Too much of anything will. And it seems to me that jury duty falls within the gamut of reasonable impositions that a society, especially with crime rates as high as ours and the desire to give people fair trials, needs to impose. And we do it as democratically and fairly as we're able. And you can, in fact, simply go to, you know, the judge and say, these are the reasons why I can't be on this jury. And, I mean, I think it varies by jurisdiction, but you can get out of it. It seems to me that it's a much more reasonable institution than this broad brush idea of mandatory national service.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would be skeptical of mandatory national service myself, in the sense that I do think that anything that massive is going to probably have kind of, you know, where you having to make compulsory could have kind of a lowest common denominator quality to it. But I don't really have a problem with giving people incentives to do this kind of thing. I mean, I think it has to do with two issues, I suppose. First is, how much good do you think this kind of stuff will do for the country in terms of solving problems? I mean, I'm sympathetic when you think about how many how many kids there are growing up without fathers, and how many elderly people there are in the United States who are just totally starved of human contact. It seems to me that you could do a lot of good by giving kids some encouragement, some money for college or whatever, by encouraging them to get involved in that kind of thing. It wouldn't be quite as clear cut as the need to serve the country in a war, but it would be pretty. It would tangibly improve the society. And the other question, which I think liberals tend to worry more about than conservatives, but is the kind of the argument that kind of Mickey Kaus made in that book of his, The End of Equality, years ago, which is just that there are fewer public spheres where people really mix across class lines. And it seems to me, that we have there was really something very valuable about the World War II experience as it relates to people's willingness to discuss the military. We have a situation now where so few people have a connection to the military that they walk on eggshells when they're discussing military issues because they don't have the credibility. And I think to some degree, the whole way in which both conservative and liberal elites today talk about middle America is conditioned by the fact that they have kind of spent their lives in institutions that are so insulated from them. I kind of like, going back to Irving Kristol, I kind of like the way that Irving Kristol, talked about his experience going into World War II, having these grand dreams about building socialism in the United States, meeting these guys from, I think it was Cicero, Illinois, and deciding, well, basically, and now I've seen what common, average Americans are like, I realize that that's not going to work. I mean, it's that kind of, you both have a certain condescension that comes from a lack of actual genuine connection across class lines, but are also a kind of idealization. And I think both of them are kind of distorted of our public debate. And I think giving people the opportunity to overcome that would be valuable.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, as I said, there are a lot of benefits to the draft, military service did amazing, made amazing leaps and bounds for African Americans, in terms of integrating African Americans, mm-hmm. for to a certain extent, gay Americans. I mean, a lot of the sort of the loss of anomie in this, mm-hmm. idea that gay guys were alone in the world came, mm-hmm. from military service. Mm-hmm. Same thing with women. I mean, huge strides for feminism have been made in military service, and I've always sort of been perplexed at why that doesn't get more props from the left. But it's funny. There's a conservative critique of this military service stuff that has largely sort of gone down the rabbit hole. I mean, Russell Kirk, after World War II, was adamant that we demilitarize and demobilize the army as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. precisely because of the sort of mass-scale industrialization that he thought that stuff represented, that it, we created a homogenized cookie-cutter America. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I think historians, I mean, it's discussed by historians, but I always thought was sort of under-discussed was the role that World War II had in creating the sense of homogeneity, mm-hmm. Of the 1950s.
Yeah,
the man in the gray flannel suit was the reason why he wore a gray flannel suit like everybody else in a gray flannel suit and took orders so well. It was because he had been enculturated through, first of all, through the New Deal, which played its, mm-hmm. role in this stuff too, but really through his experience in World War II. Mm-hmm. And it created that sort of button-down, one-size-fits-all culture. I mean, I think the 1950s was actually more intellectually vibrant decade than people, often think, but sort of the mass culture that you get after World War II has a lot to do with World War II. And that's sort of the point I'm getting to about culture.
we'd also gone decades. We've closed the borders for several decades. So I think that also allowed a certain homogenization to
right,
be called.
Right.
Well, maybe we should go on to topic number three.
I think we should.
I wrote a fairly long essay in this new journal edited by Lawrence Kaplan called World Affairs, and then I did a shorter version in the Washington Post on Sunday about both what the politics of foreign policy are this year and what I think liberals should believe about foreign policy right now.
But why don't you tell us about it?
I would be very happy to. In fact, I was about to do just that. But just the politics part of it was that I don't think that Barack Obama really has much to worry about at all in terms of looking soft or weak on national security. And I basically the point I made was that people have focused a lot on the dangers for Democrats in past elections of looking too dovish. But I think that we've kind of forgotten that actually past conservative presidents, Republican presidents, have been very, very alive to the dangers of looking too hawkish. And that actually, my argument I made was that conservative success in presidential elections as it relates to foreign policy has really been about holding the center by making sure not to be too hawkish while marginalizing liberals on the left. So that, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was the guy who ended the war in Korea, which was really important to his victory in 1952. You know, Richard Nixon ran in 1968 on promising to end the war in Vietnam, and by 1972 he had withdrawn the ground troops. Reagan, as the 1984 election came close, withdrew American troops from Lebanon because that peacekeeping mission had become unpopular. And he actually started making all these overtures to the Soviets during the election year of 1984 because they thought he looked too much like a warmonger. So my argument is that actually we haven't quite recognized how much of a fundamental deviation from those successful political Republican models has been George W. Bush and John McCain's decision to go forward with the surge in the teeth of American public opinion. And I thought it was significant that James Baker, who was Reagan's chief of staff, who was the guy who really helped to orchestrate Reagan's move to the center as he ran in 1984, kind of gave Bush that same advice with Baker Hamilton as Bush was approaching 2006, 2007, and Bush didn't take it. So anyway, that's my little advertisement for my article, or at least part of the article, and I thought I would see whether it sounds remotely convincing to you at all.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think just general plugging of new magazines, because I'm always in favor of new magazines. So far, World Affairs Journal seems like a really interesting and great little publication. I don't know what its readership is. It sounds, you know, since this is Irving Kristol Day, you know, Irving Kristol at the PI used to have this, you know, rule that if you had more than 6,000 readers, mm-hmm. You were doing something wrong. So I don't know, but it seems like it's...
Maybe doing something right.
Maybe doing something right. Yeah, so anyway, I think that's certainly all defensible. I mean, the devil lay in the details of your argument. I mean, it seems to me where I thought you were going... Is and what I actually sort of believe is, I mean, I think you're generally right. I think when it comes to Obama, I think he's very lucky that the surge worked. And in some ways, it's sort of counterintuitive. But if the situation were in Iraq were worse. Maybe not as bad as 2003 or 2005, kind of bad. But if the situation in Iraq seemed more delicate and precarious, it would be worse for Obama, because then people would say, "We can't take the risk on this guy." But if it seems like things are chugging along nicely in Iraq, which I think, again, as a gross generalization, you can say, then. It sort of takes the issue off the table, much the same way as sort of this Second Amendment Supreme Court case, you know, with guns. It took the issue away from Obama, or really, I should say, it took the issue away from McCain to use against Obama. And I think the success of the surge, you know, McCain would like to make the surge the centerpiece of his campaign. I mean, this is something that, you know, Rich Lowry talks a lot about. There's this mantra out there about let McCain be McCain. Mm. If we let McCain be McCain, all he would do is talk about Iraq. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And American people don't want to hear about Iraq. Mm. And the fact that the surge has worked, I think, reflects well on Bush and reflects well on McCain. And whether you think the surge has worked or not, we can have an argument another time. But I think the perception that the surge has worked reflects well on them, in my mind. But it also, I think, takes the issue off the table. And I think that helps Obama immensely, because the American people want to turn the page. American people want something new. They want to vote for this charismatic, impressive black guy. And I think at the end of the day, national security was going to be one of those things that would have kept them from doing it. And now that it's less of a front burner issue, I think he's got a better shot at winning the whole shebang.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with you or not. I mean, I can see the argument that it turns it more into a domestic focused election, and with the economy really bad and McCain kind of weak on the economy, that's a very difficult place for McCain to play. On the other hand, were Iraq really in flames, I think there would have been a lot of, had the surge really obviously failed, I think that there would have been a lot of dissension even in the Republican Party about the strategy. And I think that would have really caused, I mean, the Democrats have stayed united on their policy because the Democrats are in the mood to be united. Republicans are not particularly in the mood to be united. And I think that had the surge been a disaster, you would have seen a lot of prominent Republicans in Congress and other places starting to run against the surge. And even some of McCain's primary opponents, like a Romney, might have run against the surge. And I think that would have caused a different set of problems for McCain.
No, I agree with that entirely. But again, I sort of said, you know, had to be doing a little, if it had to be doing better, it couldn't be doing as bad as 2005.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if the surge were less successful, and Iraq seemed like, but Iraq still seemed winnable, whatever winnable means,
mm-hmm.
I think it would have been worse for Obama. I think now, what happens in Iraq doesn't matter. I mean, this is actually a good topic for Blogging Heads, whether or not we'll see more continuity or change. We would see more continuity or change in the Obama administration, I think, is an interesting question. Personally, I think Obama's hands are largely tied when it comes to Iraq. But that's a subject for another day. I'm trying to think what the disagreement, just so we can continue plugging your World Affairs article.
I have a whole other set of part of that argument about how I think actually Woodrow Wilson's vision of your favorite president, Woodrow Wilson's vision of collective security, is actually the signature liberal idea in foreign policy, the idea that America's interests are better served by cooperation with other countries than by conflict. But I actually think that in a But just to go back to the Iraq point, I mean, I think the thing which has hurt McCain more than Iraq, I think he's had trouble because the surge has done better than expected. I think he would have had trouble if it had been done worse as well. I think the biggest problem that he's had is simply that there hasn't been another terrorist attack since 9/11. And he invested, as did all conservatives, and some liberals, like myself, invested an enormous amount in the idea that the war on terror was the defining central prism for American foreign policy. Whereas I think, although liberals didn't state it, there was still a hangover liberal sense that maybe the best way of understanding the central challenges in American foreign policy was still Bill Clinton's old idea of globalization, with a particular emphasis on the way in which that potentially undermined Americans' quality of life economically. And I think what we've seen in the past few years is that because we haven't had another terrorist attack, the relevance of the war on terror prism, which was so central to Bush's re-election campaign in 2004, remember, you know, the convention in New York held on the anniversary of 9/11 and all that, has started to seem less apt, even though John McCain believes it very sincerely. And the globalization prism, particularly with its emphasis on economic anxiety, has started to seem more relevant, and that is the more natural democratic or liberal prism, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's sort of another analogy to the surge. I mean, some liberals would argue that the war on terror was always an exaggerated thing and was never that big a problem. I mean, certainly that's sort of the Wesley Clark kind of treat it like a law enforcement issue kind of position. Others would say that the United States has been so successful in prosecuting the war on terror that we prevented another attack on the homeland, which everybody thought was going to happen, and thereby diffusing the issue and the salience of the issue. And it's funny, you know that Charlie Black mini scandal where he said, you know, that if there's another 9/11, it's bad for Obama. I mean, you're just one of countless liberals I've met, never mind conservatives. That was one of the better examples of a Michael Kinsley's gaffe.
I totally agree.
You know, and yet everyone sort of treated it as if it was this outrageous thing to say. And I find it interesting. I'm not wholly sure. I mean, I think it's interesting why some things become taboos in politics. And I think it is fascinating that it should outrage people to say such a thing when I've yet to meet anybody who doesn't believe it's true.
Well, I think it's I agree. I think it was a ridiculous non-scandal. It has to do with the fact that people are unwilling to make the distinction. The press is unwilling to make the distinction between speculating about what would happen if something did, what would happen if an event did occur, and seeming to want that event to occur. I mean, it's an obvious distinction. Obviously, Charlie Black does not want a terrorist attack to occur. But when he says that McCain would benefit, people then can say, well, he sounds like he's implying that it would be a good thing. And I think that's where I think it was unfair, and it was a whole kind of a bunch ado about nothing. But I think that's the reason that that people were treated it like a taboo.
Yeah, you may be right. I mean, what drives me crazy about it is this tendency that has a long, long pedigree of Republicans to talk about the process rather than read their scripts. I mean, you know, like Bob Dole saying in 96, you know, should I go negative? Or my favorite example was the first president, Bush. You know, it was a classic example of reading your stage direction rather than your script, where he says, I want to appear as if I am distancing myself as much as possible from David Duke.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, come on. But anyway, I mean, the interesting question to me, and what I'm sort of on the this ain't over yet side of this argument, is that I don't think the war on terror, maybe the war on terror was exaggerated, that's possible, but I don't think it was, you know, you can only exaggerate a truth. You can't exaggerate a lie. I think there's something very real and serious about the war on terror, about the threat of you know, the sort of jihadi movements. I think it represents something that's going to be around for a very long time. I think it has tendrils that go through our own societies and cultures in weird and discomforting ways. And so I do think that there will be another 9/11 style attack. And when it happens, where it happens, and all of the rest is obviously unknowable. I hope it certainly doesn't happen. But if I didn't believe that was going to happen, I would also believe that the war on terror wasn't all that serious a thing. And since I do believe it is that serious a thing, and I think that these people are motivated to do it, it may be that this is just a mini little holiday from history, 1990s style, and that, you know, that history comes roaring back in ways that we would have thought were going to be obvious in, say, 2002.
Yes, although I think, you know, I think it's interesting that conservatives tend to describe periods that are not defined by military conflict as holidays from history. I think there's something very revealing there. I don't think the 90s were a holiday from history. I think a lot of history took place in the 1990s, but I think that and I think it says something about the Hobbesian way that conservatives see the world, that they tend to imagine that these things, they can only see these things as interludes between reality. Whereas I think that part of the liberal effort is always, in fact, to believe that they can be reality and try to extend them. Not, I mean, you can be naive about that, it's true, but I think that, anyway, I've always...
It's an interesting point. I was basically using it as shorthand for, you know, something to convey, you know, a heuristic device to convey a certain, you know, retrenchment. I mean, certainly you can say that America has turned it. If you're defining history in the sort of this Hegelian sort of, you know, world affairs kind of way, the sort of turning away from foreign affairs and those kinds of things is a holiday from history of a sort. And we are certainly seeing that in both the Democratic and Republican, you know, in America, of, you know, a turning away from obsessions with foreign policy and international affairs and global affairs towards closer to home issues like gas and all that kind of thing. And maybe the phrase holiday from history is the wrong phrase, but I do think it isn't necessarily revealing of a bellicose, sabers and ironclads view of history.
Well, on that note, talking about holidays, we should take a holiday from Blogging Heads, and I will see you again soon.
All right, Peter. Great to talk to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.